From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Trump is in California holding fundraisers. While en route, he told reporters, "We can't let Los Angeles, San Francisco, and other cities destroy themselves by allowing what's happening," meaning homelessness. There's been reporting about anonymous administration officials saying they're considering raising homeless tent camps. Last week, federal officials toured an abandoned building in L.A., baffling local officials who weren't contacted about a possible shelter. And a White House report says a big part of the problem is overregulation of housing markets. Adam Murray is executive director of the Inner City Law Center. They give free legal help to the homeless in L.A. Adam, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And address what the president said today. He said that he's hearing personally from tenants in the state, some of them foreigners. He's expressed sympathy for real estate investors and others who say their property values, their quality of life are threatened, that people are living in the doorways to prestigious buildings. The best entrances to buildings is what the president said. They're on the highways, our best streets. He says it's a problem that he has to take care of.
So I think the administration's recent remarks and their recent report are really quite unfortunate and really atrocious on many levels. The recent report is a bunch of random theories and empty or half solutions. The president's remarks and those of his staff and those in report just fundamentally misunderstand what's going on with homelessness and what's needed to solve it. It is the usual playbook of the solution that they believe. The solution is always to deregulate, to cut taxes, and to put people in cages. And unfortunately, the recent remarks tick all three of those boxes.
Well, what do you think the report means when it says the overregulation of housing markets is part of the problem?
First, let me just say there are a couple of good things in the report and a handful of things that are called out that I think we need to uplift and highlight. But the philosophical underpinning that seems to suggest or does directly suggest that the problem here is the people on the streets, and that what we need to do is we need to make it more difficult for them to be on the streets. The report calls for fewer shelters and more policing, and it usually literally uses the language to make it less tolerable for people to sleep on the streets. So the idea that the solution here is we need to make it more difficult for folks, and we need to lock them up if they don't agree to fix this problem, I think just fundamentally misunderstands the fact that people are struggling because of a housing market that's not providing affordable housing.
Well, Adam, the president and his agencies make the point that there is too much regulation, that there's a need to cut rent control, to stop the zoning, the preservation of historic areas, for instance, so that there can be more construction, more housing. Is that a point?
I think one of the few kernels of truth in this report is the tying of housing affordability and housing prices to our homelessness crisis. I think the report is accurate when it states that the increase in housing prices and rental prices is driving homelessness higher. I think the solutions, however, that are laid out in the report and in the administration's remarks about this topic are way oversimplifications. You know, people who are living on the streets, for the most part, cannot afford to pay much in rent. And the idea that if we just would free up the private market, that they will come in and provide housing for tons of these folks is just not a realistic situation or a realistic proposal, and is not borne out by any evidence.
There's been a lot of conversation about homelessness in the state, and usually it's with some sympathy for the people who are homeless because of things we've talked about, the extraordinary cost of living, the fires which have displaced so many people in the northern part of the state. The president is talking about investors who come from other countries and move to Los Angeles or San Francisco because of the prestige of the city, and all of a sudden they have tents and people living at the entrance to their office building.
So that's not where my sympathies lie or my empathy lies. I'm concerned about the fact that in Los Angeles, for example, we have almost 60,000 human beings who are sleeping on the streets tonight. Each one of them is somebody's son or somebody's daughter. If my children were on the streets, I would want anybody who could do anything to do it to help move these folks into housing and change that trajectory and their pathway of where they have to live. And that doesn't seem to be the focus of this administration. There's a throwaway line in this report. It's literally just one sentence that I think should have been much more the focus of the report. They acknowledge that we are having increasingly increasingly having success across the country with programs that are seeking to prevent homelessness before it happens. I would love to see much more attention on how do we bolster the housing stability of precariously housed families and how do we keep them from becoming homeless in the first place. That's a far more cost-effective approach. It's a far more humane approach because then the family doesn't end up on the streets and end up split up and end up with all sorts of additional health issues that they didn't have before. And there's literally one line in this report that sort of holds out that promise and then no discussion about it whatsoever.
Well, and so there might be a silver lining here in that the president is bringing his firepower to this. But do you think there's something else going on here? Because the state of California has bucked President Trump at every turn, and now the White House seems to be fighting back, attacking the emission standards there and portraying the state as one that can't handle its own homeless problem, which is a huge problem in the state.
So I don't know what the political motivation is for these sorts of what feel like attacks on these issues and not particularly productive or helpful policy solutions. I will say that I think the federal government for decades has been absent on this challenge of affordable housing and homelessness. This is not a new challenge, and this is not a new thing that the federal government is not stepping up and helping. It's really been since the 1980s that the federal government has increasingly gotten out of the business of trying to help encourage and support and fund affordable housing throughout the country.
That's Adam Murray, executive director of the Inner City Law Center, a nonprofit law firm that's been giving free legal help to homeless people in LA since 1980. Adam, thank you.
Thank you for having me, Robin.
President Trump has announced a new national security advisor. Robert O'Brien served as an ambassador with the U.S. Special Presidential Envoy for Hostage Affairs. His appointment does not require confirmation by the Senate, and it comes amid escalating tensions in the Persian Gulf. NPR national security correspondent Greg Myrie joins us now. Hi, Greg.
Hey, Tanya.
So what can you tell us about Robert O'Brien?
Well, as you mentioned, for the past couple years, he's been working on trying to get American hostages abroad released. And he's had some success, helped free Americans who are being held in places like North Korea and Yemen. There's perhaps up to 20 or so Americans still being held. But listeners may, the case they may be most familiar with is that of ASAP Rocky. Now, he was the rapper who faced assault charges in Sweden. O'Brien went there last month to monitor that case. And again, obviously a legal case, not a hostage situation. ASAP Rocky was found guilty and was sort of released on time served and has come back. O'Brien, meanwhile, most of his career, he's been a lawyer in California, punctuated with these sort of periods of government services, as he's been doing most recently.
A big question that folks have, they'll be comparing him to John Bolton, which we know was known as a hawk. He pushed for military intervention on the world stage. What's O'Brien like in comparison?
Well, almost polar opposites in terms of temperament and personality. O'Brien, obviously a lesser-known figure. He's low-key, behind the scenes, a negotiator. The job he had required discretion, put a premium on discussions and negotiations. He hasn't expressed strong public opinions, and we don't know exactly where he stands. And he's probably likely to emphasize the advisor role in National Security Advisor rather than being a strong advocate for a specific policy as Bolton was.
Speaking about that role and how that role plays into the Trump administration, President Trump has already been through three security advisors, including Bolton. What's really the state of the White House's national security team right now?
Well, it's never been an orderly process under this president. You know, going back to his first national security advisor, Michael Flynn, who didn't even last a month. Now, some would say this is an impossible job because of the way the president operates, acting on his gut and making unpredictable moves, and that he doesn't really want any sort of process. And O'Brien is likely to struggle, as his predecessors have, to create some sort of orderly process when it comes to national security.
This appointment also comes at a particularly tense time, with the administration blaming Iran for the drone attacks against Saudi Arabia. What do we know about how O'Brien might approach this?
We don't really know, because he doesn't express these public opinions on these kinds of questions. But based on his career, I think we could expect somebody who will take a measured lawyerly approach, someone who has this deep experience as a negotiator. That'll sort of be his point, rather than publicly expressing strong opinions. He is on Twitter, but all this all his tweets have been about getting hostages released, or his efforts are retweeting the president, or Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State. He doesn't express his personal opinions.
Very quickly, we have about 30 seconds. I mean, a question that probably a lot of people have is, if the president fires advisors he agrees with, what use is this position anyway? I mean, it seems that the Trump administration has been redefining this role of national security advisor.
Yeah, I mean, I think the president has even said, well, actually, it's a pretty easy job because I don't really take advice. I make my own decisions. But traditionally, the national security advisor tries to pull together different opinions, State Department, Pentagon, and offer those suggestions to the president. Presumably, that's the kind of role O'Brien would try to play.
That's NPR national security correspondent Greg Myrie. Thank you, Greg.
Thank you, Tanya.
Maybe you're up with the sun. Or maybe you're, well, not a morning person. Either way, you can hear Morning Edition from NPR News on your schedule. It's on demand, weekdays 7 to 3. Just say, Alexa, play Morning Edition.
This is Here and Now, broadcasting from Tempe, Arizona, and the headline in the local paper caught our attention this week. The National Weather Service predicts there will be no more 110 degree days in Phoenix for the rest of the year. Hallelujah, absolutely, because the temperature exceeded 110 degrees 29 days this summer. That is the fourth most of all time. We wanted to get an idea of how people here will adapt to the heat, especially as the climate gets hotter and drier in the future. So we met with ASU Professor Ariana Medell at the hottest place on campus. And Professor, thank you for joining us here. It is 79 degrees right now, so it's actually quite balmy and beautiful.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Yeah, it's really nice out, and I'm glad we won't have any more 110 degree days this year. We have had many of them. And in fact, if you look at the temperatures that are above 100, usually we can hit up to 100 days that are 100 degrees Fahrenheit or more. And that's going to become much worse in the future, because it's predicted that conditions become more extreme and heat waves become more frequent and may last longer, too.
It's hard to imagine this city getting any hotter. On June 26, 1990, the temperature soared to 122 degrees. That record still stands. But with a changing climate, it may not for long. That's why the work of Medell and her assistant Marty is so important.
Yeah, Marty can measure how you experience temperature. So if you look at the weather forecast, you usually get air temperature in the forecast, but that doesn't necessarily represent how you experience the temperature, because there's a big difference if you're standing in the shade or if you're standing in the sun. So Marty can pick up those differences and tell you how you feel if you're in the shade or in the sun.
And we should let listeners know that Marty is a robot.
Yeah, Marty actually is a robot. Marty is a mobile weather station.
You use Marty quite a bit in helping gauge temperature all throughout campus.
Yes, we took Marty all across campus and we measured a variety of locations. We measured how you would feel under a tree in shade. We measured how you would feel in the middle of the Hayden Library lawn, which is a huge grass area with the walkway. We measured how you would feel under power parasols, which are shade structures that produce energy. They're solar structures. And then we compared the locations to see which ones were more comfortable than others.
We are in the middle of what appears to be concrete buildings on campus. This is the hottest place on campus. How is it the hottest place on campus? And tell us how you know it.
Yeah, so this is the hottest place on campus, mainly because there is so much concrete that's surrounding you. It's like a concrete jungle, essentially. So there's concrete underneath, the buildings are concrete, and it's a very light surface, so it has a very high reflectivity. So as the sun hits the surface, the light is reflected back at you, and that makes you feel much more uncomfortable.
In this fast-growing 517-square-mile city, concrete and asphalt are everywhere, which means people here have a hard time escaping the heat. In Arizona, heat-related deaths tripled from 2014 to 2017.
There are two ways people can adapt. One is through behavior, changing their behavior, getting up earlier or staying up longer, shifting their activities to the early morning or the late evening. And the second way to adapt is to try to modify the urban environment to make it more comfortable for people outdoors.
Yeah, and this is where your work comes in and thinking about that. One of the things, though, that I'm thinking about is the fact that folks who live in the desert have adapted for so long in the heat. It's part of what folks do here. But part of the ways that they've been working to adapt is through things like air conditioning, which contributes to climate change. What are some ways that you're suggesting folks do this without further burdening the environment?
So one important factor when you think about how people feel outdoors in this environment is actually the radiation or the amount of shade that you have in the urban fabric. So if you are able to increase the amount of shade in the urban environment, you make it more comfortable for people outdoors, and it increases the likelihood that people are actually active outdoors.
We've seen the nighttime temperatures in the city go up by an average of 9 degrees. Can you talk about why this is happening and what impact this really has on our bodies?
Yeah, so this is a phenomenon called the urban heat island effect. And that happens because as we urbanize these areas that we move to, we bring in all these artificial surfaces. So we bring in concrete, we build asphalt parking lots and roads, and all of these different surfaces have the characteristic that they can store the heat during the day as the sun hits those surfaces, and then at night they slowly release the heat. So as it becomes dark, there's still this heat in those surfaces, and this heat gets released slowly, which makes it much warmer at night, which is bad because that increases the demand for energy use, for air conditioning, for example, and it doesn't really give people a relief from the heat that they experience during the day.
This is amazing to hear because so much of this city is built up with concrete. Have you talked with city officials about your research and what this means perhaps for the future in building up the city as it continues to grow?
Yeah, so we work a lot with the city of Tempe, the city of Phoenix, trying to mainly measure the conditions outdoors to come up with recommendations that they can use and hopefully translate into policy. And those changes include planting trees, producing more shade, using more permeable surfaces that don't store the heat as much, maybe even looking into cool surfaces, highly reflective surfaces, although those actually decrease thermal comfort because of the increased radiation. So there are various ways you can mitigate the heat, try to mitigate the heat to make it more comfortable here.
What can other parts of the world learn from the work that you all are doing here and learning about heat adaptability?
Yeah, we're in a very unique situation here in Phoenix because it is already hot, and a lot of places in the future elsewhere are predicted to become hotter. So as we have these almost ideal conditions in terms of the heat, it's a perfect place to test certain mitigation strategies and see what works and what doesn't work, so that then in the future other places around the world can use those strategies to adapt.
I'm sure Marty let you all know scientifically about the hottest places, not only on this campus, but in the city. But I'm sure that students and other folks probably could have given you unscientific research as well about the places that are the hottest here. Is this corridor that we're standing in a place that students try to avoid as they're walking through to campus and classes?
Actually, it is. So if you look at this place, it's mostly used by bikers. So you have people biking
See a biker driving past right now.
Yeah, so be careful, there's a bike here. Because there's just north of here, just 20 yards away, there is a tunnel through a building, and usually people walk through that tunnel over there and they avoid this concrete path that we're standing on right now. So it's mainly used by bikers.
Or at this time of day when the sun is not here yet. Not all shade is created equally when we're talking about finding places of relief.
Yes, so we currently have an ongoing study that we call 50 Grades of Shade, where we investigate 50 different shade types across campus and in parks. So we look at various tree species, we look at awnings, umbrellas, shade sails, you name it, any type of shade you can find in the urban environment. And the idea is that there are a lot of places in the urban environment where you can't plant trees because there are sewer systems underground or cables for internet or things that obstruct you from planting a tree. So we want to find out if there are other alternative shade types that could be used in those instances.
For instance, which might be a surprise for folks, a parasol, for instance, does not provide the same kind of shade as a tree.
Yes, so if you look at a tree versus an umbrella or versus an artificial shade structure, there are differences in the density of the shade that's being provided. So if you have a very solid and dense shade, for example, from an umbrella, that will help a lot. Whereas if you have a tree such as a Palo Verde that has very tiny leaves and is not very dense, that will not provide as much shade. But then another thing to consider is how far away the shade structure is from your head. So if you have a shade structure such as the solar structure, the power parasol that's in front of the MU, that is very far away from your head. It's 10 meters tall. So as the shade structure heats up, the heat doesn't really transfer down to you because it's so far away. But if you have, say, an umbrella that's very close to your head, if the umbrella heats up, that will heat you up as well. So as we're looking at the differences in effectiveness of shade, I just want to add that any shade is good. It's not, if one shade doesn't perform as well as the other, doesn't mean you shouldn't use it. It's just any shade helps.
Yeah. When it comes to shade versus no shade, you've done a lot of work, you and your colleagues. Ultimately, what's at stake when we're talking about figuring out these issues around the hottest places and why people should know about this and why people should understand shade?
Well, at stake is the livability of the city and the cities around the world, because as it gets hotter and less comfortable, we don't want to revert to air conditioning as the only solution. We want to have the environment comfortable so that people can actually be outdoors and be active. And the more we can do to help people be active and mitigate heat outdoors, the better we'll be off in the future.
Ariana Medel, professor at Arizona State University, and Marty the Robot, thank you so much for joining us here.
Thanks for having us.
This conversation is part of Covering Climate Now, a global collaboration of more than 250 news outlets around the world. You can hear all of our climate coverage at hereandnow.org.
And it was a combative 5 hours on Capitol Hill yesterday. We have a brief recap. Former Trump campaign manager Corey Lewandowski began his testimony at the House Judiciary Committee criticizing the impeachment inquiry he was in front of.
As for actual collusion or conspiracy, there was none. What there has been, however, is harassment of this president from the day he won the election. We as a nation would be better served if elected officials like yourself concentrated your efforts to combat the true crises facing our country, as opposed to going down rabbit holes like this hearing.
Democrats portrayed Lewandowski as the president's enforcer. Many brought up a 2017 incident detailed in the Mueller report, President Trump asking Lewandowski to ask then-Attorney General Jeff Sessions to limit the Russia investigation. Lewandowski confirmed that was true, but denied being asked to do anything illegal. Here's Representative Steve Cohen, the Democrat of Tennessee.
And you were a policeman at one time, so you know something about the law and about following the law. Didn't you think it was a little strange that the president would sit down with you one-on-one and ask you to do something that you knew was against the law? Did that strike you as strange?
I disagree with the premise of your question, Congressman.
You weren't a policeman?
I didn't think the president asked me to do anything illegal.
You didn't think it would have been illegal for you to ask Mr. Sessions to drop the investigation and to just go on to future presidents and omit everything with this president and go ollie ollie in free? We're going to start with the next one about colluding with Russia. You didn't think that was illegal to obstruct justice?
Congressman, the president has asked me anything illegal.
Well, Lewandowski was then asked about statements he made on MSNBC in May that he didn't even remember being asked by the president to get involved with Jeff Sessions. Here's an exchange he had with Barry Burke, an attorney for the House Democrats on the committee.
Sir, is it your testimony before this committee that when you said you did not remember the president ever asking you to get involved with Jeff Sessions or the Department of Justice, you were saying you were being truthful? And, sir, I don't believe there's any reason to consult with your counsel. The question is, are you a truth teller in that interview?
I'm a truth teller every time I stand before Congress or a committee of jurisdiction and raise my hand and swear to God under oath.
My question, sir, is when you said the president never asked you to get involved with Mr. Sessions.
I have no obligation to have a candid conversation with the media whatsoever, just like they have no obligation to cover me honestly, and they do it inaccurately all the time.
So you're admitting that on national television you were lying there.
What I'm saying is they have been inaccurate on many occasions, and perhaps I was inaccurate at that time.
Well, Republican Congressman Steve Chabot of Ohio tried to draw attention to other issues he wanted the committee to focus on.
This committee has such a rich history. His jurisdiction over a whole lot of very significant things. We're spending our time on this fake impeachment, but we could be focused on something that really matters, like immigration, asylum. We have hundreds of thousands of people that have entered our southern border.
Lewandowski appeared to have other issues on his mind as well during the hearing, such as his potential New Hampshire Senate run. He requested a break at one point and used that time to tweet out a link to a super PAC, Stand With Corey, which was created yesterday. We'll follow this story.
Chances are, you've been hearing about the 400th anniversary of when the first enslaved Africans arrived on America's shores. U.S. Senator Chuck Schumer, just last week, spoke about it at a commemoration ceremony.
400 years ago, they came here, 20 and odd Africans, forcibly taken from their homelands, separated from their families, shackled below decks on a terrible journey to a strange land, never to return.
Senator Schumer learned about the significance of this date from the 1619 Project. It's a collection of essays published in the New York Times Magazine. The entire magazine is dedicated to the topic, which ties the systems and cultural norms created during slavery to today. This project was spearheaded by Nicole Hannah Jones, an award-winning investigative journalist covering racial justice for The Times. And I caught up with Nicole recently to talk about the impact this project has had so far on America's collective understanding of not only slavery, but the impacts of it, which Jones says is deeply embedded into the fabric of this country.
When I pitched this project, I was very, very intentional and very clear that this was not just going to be a history, that we were going to show that you can look all across American life in all of these different aspects of our society and many things that you think have nothing to do with slavery. And we're going to actually, through very rigorous reporting and history, show you that these all have connections to the legacy of slavery and the anti-Black racism.
Jones says she and her colleagues were intentional in drawing a through line. For instance, there are essays about the treatment of enslaved people and how migrant factory workers are treated today, how prisons owe their cruelty to slavery, even how Black music is a purely American sound. It's such a profound reframing that people have had visceral reactions to it. For instance, you can actually watch unboxing videos of people receiving copies in the mail.
Oh my God, y'all, I have been looking for this and kind of done brought it. She is the plug. Oh my God.
No. I ain't know if I'd be able to get it. Look that area where I could. But your boy done found it. Your boy bought two copies in it. They ain't know.
Been waiting on this. Finally here. 1619 Project. About to buckle up for this one.
And just a few weeks ago, Jones and her colleagues announced they'd be handing out free copies of the magazine in front of the Times in New York. And with a line wrapped around the building, 2,000 copies were gone within minutes.
I just got a email from Assistant Superintendent in Newark, and she said that parents came to the school board meeting with copies of the 1619 project and said, we want this being taught to our kids in the curriculum. Mm. These parents are very unlikely to be the kind of quote-unquote typical Times reader. I have had people of every demographic who... Demographic within the Black community. So, you know, not just your college-educated, quote-unquote, professional class who have read it and heard it, but regular working folks like the people in my family and come up to me and said, I got a copy for myself and I sent a copy to my 90-year-old mother in Alabama because she'd heard of it and she wanted it. So, again, I think it is the quality of the production and the argument, but also producing something that speaks so directly to these communities in a way that respects them and their stories that we don't see a lot. And we're very, very conscious of who the typical Times readers are and that this project needed to get into the hands of people who are not our typical readership. So yes, I did personally fundraise in order to print more than 200,000 additional copies that we were and are distributing in communities that unless you get home delivery, you actually can't even go, you know, into your supermarket or your gas station and pick up the New York Times.
On the other side of this, there have been haters on this project. Newt Gingrich tweeted and talked about it on Fox News. And of course you expected that, but I'm listening to all of this and I'm thinking it's much more than that. There are these think pieces out there calling on you and your colleagues' work and saying that you're lies. It really comes down to a denial of history. What do you think this says about us?
We have been, I mean, I lay this out in my opening essay for the project. We have been a country built on a lie. We have been a country that from the beginning has tried to hide the paradox of our founding, that the men we call our founding fathers knew from the start that what they were doing was wrong and hypocritical and stood in the face of the stated values that they put out in the founding documents. And so we have been engaged in a 250-year cover-up ever since then. And, you know, every country creates its myths, and its myths tell you, you know, give you a sense of pride and a sense of shared history. And Black people are just the obstacle to that because we are the daily reminder of that lie. And so the resistance to this reframing that one says we have to stop deifying our founding, we have to stop deifying these men we call our founders, because not only were they flawed, they engaged in one of the most atrocious things that we ever could. Of course, there's going to be pushback to that. Then to take those people who have been placed on the very bottom of the racial caste system in this country, who have always been considered the least, and to make the argument that we are actually not the least, that we are the most American, I knew that that was an evocative argument, and I expected actually more pushback than I received. And to make that argument in the New York Times versus making it in a book or making it in another publication legitimizes that argument in a way that people who are very much invested in the idea of Black pathology and of American exceptionalism are uncomfortable with. What they cannot actually dispute are the facts. You can't dispute that the first 10 of our first 12 presidents were enslavers. You can't dispute the fact that we were one of the last countries in the Americas to end the institution of slavery, that we engaged in racial apartheid for 100 years. That was so appalling that Nazi Germany used it as a model. You can't argue those facts. People don't like the framing. I'm comfortable with people not liking the framing, but the pushback just speaks to what happens when you pierce these founding myths and you actually have to deal with the reality of what this country is.
But Jones says the responses that have moved her the most are from Black Americans.
The most important thing to me, and I'm actually gauging the success of the project based on the feedback that I'm getting and saying I've accomplished what I hope this project would accomplish, is that, you know, you grow up in a country that has marginalized your stories, that has made your stories feel insignificant, that has always treated you and your communities as problematic, with a sense of shame almost about the fact that we begin our story here with enslavement as if we were just passive throughout our entire time here and just a problem to be solved. And I want Black Americans and Black people in the diaspora to take from this, one, the understanding that we are central to this country, both in terms of the racist structures that were built to justify slavery, but also in our resistance to those structures and our kind of fundamental role, not just in building wealth, but also in building this democracy, in that we are not a problem. We have never been a problem. We have responded to, you know, some of the most appalling and atrocious generational circumstances with an abiding faith that we can make this country live up to its ideals. And I've never considered myself a patriotic person, but through bringing this project to fruition, I want Black people to feel that we have as much claims to this country as anyone else, and that we will not be marginalized out of the country that we helped build, and that we should actually take a great deal of pride and not feel that sense of shame anymore.
You received less pushback than you expected. Do you think that that might be a signal that we collectively are ready to listen?
So, yeah, I do think we are much more primed to listen. But of course, my constant frustration as a journalist who writes about racial inequality is that listening and talking is not enough. We have to address the harm. And I don't think that we're ready to address the harms. But will this listening, will this understanding then lead us back to a place where we can talk about how do we then redress the very particular harms that have been visited upon Black Americans?
That's Nicole Hannah-Jones, award-winning investigative reporter who covers civil rights and racial justice for the New York Times Magazine and one of the authors of the 1619 Project. Thanks so much for joining us, Nicole.
Thank you very much.
And we'd like to know if you've read the 1619 Project, and if so, how has it impacted you? Your thoughts are welcome at hereandnow.org.
Have you been thinking that your cuisine, your cooking, needs just a little bit of a kick? Well, how about ginger? We're taking a page from Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunst, who joins us in the studio. Kathy, great to talk to you again.
Hi, Robin.
And I recently made your corn and potato thing.
Curry,
and it had some ginger in it. Ginger,
yes,
is amazing. But for people who are afraid of it.
Yeah, well, it's a very powerful, as in positively powerful spice. It is one of the most widely cultivated spices in the world. It is a perennial, and it can take something as simple as boiling water and transform it into a very potent, beautiful, healing tea.
Which is what I have in
you
this
do.
Cup. This is your ginger tea. We're going to talk more about the recipes, but it's kind of ugly. And for people, it's like this thing,
It's gnarly. It's got this skin on it. So you have a spoon in front of
right.
you, and you have a big knob, as it's called, of ginger.
Yeah.
I want you to take your spoon like this and just scrape at it.
I'm just scraping that brown skin
exactly.
off.
Exactly.
Okay.
And you will see how easily the skin comes off and how you don't lose any of that precious ginger.
Because if you use a small knife to peel it,
you lose half of it.
Okay. All right.
So then what do? You've
got
it peeled. Then you can chop it. The other thing to do is to cut it into thin strips.
Mm-hmm.
You can buy something called a ginger grater.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a ceramic one here. You've got a bamboo one. Mm. I think they cost about $4.
Right.
And then you take your peeled ginger and you scrape it. And you'll notice that some of the ginger juice is released.
Right.
And then you get this beautiful grated ginger that you can add to dishes towards the end because it's juicy and aromatic and adds an extra ginger punch.
I use my cheese grater, but this is
You
better.
Can use your cheese grater. This is specifically designed for ginger.
Yes.
It's very fibrous, and the knobs of the ginger grater actually break it down. And if you have some very fresh ginger, which means it will look fat and fresh and not shriveled up, you're going to really get some ginger juice.
Okay, I think I'm getting high.
Oh, my God. Call the doctor.
Okay, sorry.
Here we go.
Okay, let's look at some of the dishes. This tofu dish.
Okay, this I just love. So what I did was I took a block of firm tofu and I very lightly coated it, just pressed down into a bowl of cornstarch. And then I added just like a half an inch of safflower or vegetable oil to a skillet, got it really hot, and shallow fried the tofu. So it gets this this beautiful crust, but when you cut into the tofu, it's custardy and soft. Mm. And what you're eating it on top of is a ginger broth. There are chopped ginger pieces, there are ginger slices, and there is grated ginger in there. And then there are these stir-fried greens. In this case, I had baby kale from the garden, dandelion greens. You could use Swiss chard, spinach, really healthy. All these foods with ginger. I was testing the recipes, and all of a sudden, I felt a boost of energy. And I don't mean to sound like a 1-800 ad, but like, this stuff makes you feel good.
See, you were high.
I was high, like you. Okay.
I am telling you.
More ginger is what the world needs.
And this, just the soup, it's got a lot of soy in it. That's the taste.
A little bit of soy sauce. You can use vegetable stock or chicken stock. Lots and lots of ginger. And then these beautiful stir-fried greens in it. It's a really lovely dish.
Okay, this next dish?
I got a little bit ambitious.
Yes.
I made crab and ginger dumplings. Mm-hmm. I bought wonton wrappers in a regular supermarket. I mixed fresh crab meat with lots of fresh ginger and an egg white, and you just pinch it together. It's very simple.
Really, it's just like you peel off a piece of the wonton wrapper.
Yeah, the little square, a little wrapper, put a little bit less than a tablespoon of crab meat in the center, dab a little bit of water around the edges of the dumpling wrapper, and seal it together. And then you steam it for 4 minutes. Mm. Right? Mm. And you are a happy, happy person. And then there's a very simple dipping sauce of soy sauce, rice wine vinegar, scallions, and grated and sliced ginger. So you're getting ginger in 3 different ways.
Tell me more about the health benefits.
There are some huge claims. It is an anti-inflammatory. Apparently, Chinese texts from the 4th century BC describe using ginger for treating nausea, stomach issues, cholera, and toothaches.
That's why ginger ale settles your tongue.
That's right. I have been out on sailboats, which I do not do well on, and I always chew on a piece of raw ginger, and I bring ginger ale or cold ginger tea. Ginger absolutely settles your stomach. It reduces coughs. It's really good for a cold. And some people claim it soothes a migraine.
Well, you mentioned cold tea. We have hot tea here.
This tea can go iced or hot. And what I did was I cleaned my ginger. I did not take the skin off. And I chopped it up about 1/2 cup to 4 cups of water, boil it for a while, then let it sit, and you get a very strong ginger tea. I added a little bit of fresh lemon and honey. This is so great over ice. I keep a big jar of it in the fridge, but around this time of year, hot ginger tea will fix you up.
It will.
Yeah.
I am fixed up.
There
right
you go.
Now.
It's an all-new Robin Young.
We've been talking ginger with Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunst. As always, we'll have all her recipes. These are fantastic at hereandnow.org. Kathy, thank you so much.
Thanks, Robin.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm the brand new Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.